Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. The Coffee Clatch and Special Needs Talk Radio Network feature outstanding programming for the special needs community. Our team of hosts provide educational interviews. Our shows are not designed to provide listeners with specific or personal medical, legal, or professional service or advice. Parents of children with health issues should always consult their health care provider for medical advice, medications, or treatment. Any show discussing rights and law for special needs children and special education are presented as general information and not legal advice. Special Needs Coffee Clatch Limited does not promote any host or guest's individual practice, programs, treatments, or products. We thank you for joining us and are proud to provide excellence in broadcasting for the special needs community. And now, on to the interview.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. This is Chuck Wally filling in for Marianne tonight, and Mae Wilkinson is running our Twitter tweet chat. And you can join in at tweetchat.com with the hashtag TCK. Tonight we're kicking off our 2012 Sunday night series with a special guest, Dr. Gil Tippy. Dr. Tippy is the founder and clinical director of the Rebecca School in New York City. And the Rebecca School utilizes the developmental individual differences relationship-based methodology, and they consider the variations in an individual's motor and sensory processing systems to tailor a child's program to his or her specific needs. And tonight we hope to learn a little bit more about the school, the program, and the theory behind it. So with that, Dr. Tippy, welcome to the Coffee Clatch.
Thank you very much, Chuck. It's really nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Tippy, as I understand it, you are a disciple of Dr. Stanley Greenspan. And can you tell us about the approach he pioneered and how it differs from the others? Or from some
okay,
of the others,
well,
I should say.
Disciple is probably a good way to describe me. Acolyte might be another one. He was a wonderful man who stood up and said, okay, look, we are working with kids on the autism spectrum, and thank God we are, but there are other ways of working with kids, and I want to use a relationship-based model. So he took a good look at all of the developmental theorists who are out there and said, okay, I think we can do better. So he came up with a developmental model, not unlike every other developmental child psychology model that you guys ever ran into in any of your college courses, and said, okay, this is how we're going to work. We're not going to work in the way that applied behavior analysis, which was the primary way in which kids were being worked with at the time. That was the model that was being used and probably still is the most prevalent model. And we're not going to work in that model. We're going to work in the way that human beings have always worked with their children, and we're going to assume that this is a developmental difference and that we can work with it the way that we would work with typical kids. So that's really what he decided to do. The way that it's different from applied behavior analysis models, ABA models, is that it's not using an outside reinforcer to get a kid to do something you want them to do or to get them to point to something you want them to point to or make a noise that you want them to make. Instead, it's a model where you get into a relationship with a kid in the same way that you would get into a relationship with any child, and then you use the child's interest as your way of getting in and getting the kid to be in the kind of relationship that we know all children develop in. So it's really a pretty simple model, truthfully. It's based on just good, sound child development theory, been around for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, you know, with my son, that is the first model that I ever really was introduced to, so I really didn't know any other. When you talk about outside influences, I think an example you use might be an M&M in your book, where you know you want to have a child say something, and if she says it, well, you get a treat. Am I oversimplifying that?
Well, I think the ABA people would say you're oversimplifying it, but that's the basic model, right? We're talking about taking something that the kid wants and pairing it with something that the kid doesn't want, on the theory that the kid will do the thing he doesn't want to do in order to get the reward. And that's not to say that rewards don't work. I mean, certainly a lot of us, a lot of us work for our salaries, but those of us who have jobs that we truly love and truly embrace don't work for our salaries. The salaries are how we keep our families going and keep our lives going, but we work because we love our work, and that's really the difference in the two models. Kids will do, you can get a kid to do almost anything if you give them a treat or a what an ABA therapist would call a reinforcer. And you can get them to do anything, but pretty soon all they're doing is working for the reinforcer. All they're doing is working for the treat. And if you're only working for your salary, the truth is you're going to despise what you're doing. And then when you despise what you're doing, not too much is going on in way of learning. So that's why we don't do it.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. About a year ago or so, we had author Daniel Pink on this show, and he talked about that very same thing. Yeah, so it's always great to hear that reinforced.
Well, it's really true. If you look at the early childhood stuff that's going on now, not even related to autism, all of the early childhood education basically is saying the same thing. You can't teach kids using that kind of a behavioral model. It just doesn't work.
Yep. And what Daniel Pink is always said is that, you know, to motivate employees, you need to do the same thing. You need to have them do the things they love instead of the things they have to do. So great comparisons. So what are the components of the DIR methodology? It's the Developmental Individual Differences Relationship-Based Methodology.
That's a real mouthful, right?
Yes, it is.
And it's not a very elegant model name. Dr. Greenspan would have named things that would have been almost impossible tongue twisters for people. But what it really means is that the D in the DIR model stands for development. And it's really just a typical child development model. First, a kid has to do one thing, and then they build their skills on that, and they do the next thing. And so it's a model where kids build their skills, and that's really how child development takes place. And so whether you believe Dr. Greenspan's model or whether you believe Piaget's model or whether you believe any of the other developmental theorists, that's what the D in DIR stands for. It stands for developmental. And if you don't look at kids from a developmental perspective, you really don't understand how it is that they're acquiring the skills that lead them to be able to do the things that we want everybody to be able to do. So D is developmental. The I in the DIR model is individual differences, and I think this is where the DIR model is really strong. Every single human being has ways in which they process the world that are different from other human beings. I would love to be able to move quickly, see a baseball coming toward me, move to my left effectively, pick the ball up and throw to first base in the way that Derek Jeter does, but I just can't do it. I haven't got the same kind of processing that he does. There are some things I do better than Derek Jeter, but it isn't play shortstop for the Yankees. And so we all have differences. All of us have things that we prefer and don't prefer. I might like a loud concert. You might like the symphony, and I might fall asleep. So if processing differences are the norm within all of the human population, why isn't that? Why can't we consider that amongst the kids with whom we work? So we think about that all the time in the DIR model, individual differences. And that's one of the areas that I think we're really strong in. So occupational therapy has been talking about this for a long time, sensory processing disorders. But this is the model that really takes that to heart and really looks at kids from the perspective that one of the ways in which you end up getting the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder is by having real processing difficulties. And since that's true, we want to take a look at every kid's processing system and their ability to put together a plan out of their senses. So they see something and then they have to put together a plan to go and do what they want to do. We look at that processing and say, okay, how can we support that? where is it weak, where is it strong, how are we going to work with that. So that's the I in the DIR model. And then the R is really the simple and beautiful part of the model, and that's the relationship. There isn't any learning, as you well know, having gone through, I'm making assumptions about you, but going through fairly typical schooling. And the teachers with whom you had these beautiful, loving, warm relationships where they were kind and thoughtful and really cared about you and were looking at you, that's where you did your best learning. And we know for a fact that's where kids learn best. And that's what the R in the model is about. So it's a pretty simple model with a really long and cumbersome name.
Right, right. And so you spoke about those the integration processing. And if you could you put your Serena Weidner hat on and give us a quick background there in the sensory subsystems and the relevance to the well-being of how they affect those with autism? Because it's kind of an important thing. I know, at least in my life, when I try to explain things to people, they really don't understand, especially if, you know, they don't have children with autism or special needs, or, you know, they're just finding out that their kids have, you know, autism. So what are these sensory subsystems and what are their importance?
Well, the ones that we're all taught about when we're growing up in school, your vision, your taste, your sense of smell, your hearing, and your touch, those are five of the important things that you have to pay attention to. And we really depend, surprisingly, because we do it so without thought, on all of those sensory systems linking up and being able to make sense of the world. But if one of your systems is a little slower or a little quicker or blocked entirely, if you have trouble processing your sight, for instance, then sounds come at you more quickly than your sight does. Or if you have trouble processing touch, you may not want to be touched at all. And it might also affect whether you want to walk into a classroom, because kids might be too unpredictably willing to touch you. There are two other systems that we almost never talk about, but that we think about all the time in the DIR model. One is your vestibular system. And all that is the system that, if you spin around a lot, makes you dizzy. It's the system that tells you where your head is in relationship to gravity. And the second system is your proprioceptive system, and that is the system that tells you where your body is in space. And we process those systems without ever thinking. So you can feel where your body is without looking at your hand. You know where your hand is, so you can put it on things without looking. But if you're having trouble processing that system, you're having real trouble making sense of the world. So imagine that. Yeah. You can't really feel the floor when you put your feet down. You're only processing the world in flashes through your visual system, and your hearing isn't linking up with that. Well, that's a pretty terrifying world to be in. And you're spending most of your time trying to keep yourself safe. So if those systems aren't linking up, you never really get to the point where you map even where your body is in space. If you don't do that, then you're not going to be able to map where you are in your world. And if you don't do that, and this is the part that I think it is really hard for people to understand, if you can't map the world, what Stanley used to say is, if you can see the trees but not the forest, you will never be able to be an abstract thinker. And that, for me, is really the key to getting the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. If you are working out of your really fabulous memory, and kids on the spectrum very often are, but you are not able to be abstract, then you're going to really struggle. And all of that comes out of not being able to process your sensory system. So it's a really important aspect of this whole model.
Then, so tell us about we'll get into that model and how you use it, but tell us a little bit about the Rebecca School and what physical attributes make it special and how do the teachers make it special?
Well, I just want to say that I have never met a finer, harder working, more devoted, loving group of folks than the people who work at the Rebecca School. We have the best group of teachers, TAs, occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, music therapists, OT and PT, and I know I'm probably forgetting in this list lots of other wonderful people, but they are a special group of folks. But other than that, what makes Rebecca School special is we are one of the only places anywhere that is doing purely developmental individual difference relationship-based work in a school setting. We don't do any other methodology in the school. So we are not using any applied behavior analytic techniques or any of the other methodologies. We are purely DIR. And the way we assured that we were doing that is from day one, when we were first thinking of the school, Dr. Greenspan signed on and said, okay, I'm in, I'll help you. And so he did the direct supervision from, you know, designing the classrooms to doing case conferences weekly with my staff to supervising me directly on all of the aspects of the school. So the thing that really makes us, I think, unique and of most use to the kids that we see is that we're doing DIR and we're doing it in every aspect of the school program. And that came directly out of our direct contact with Dr. Greenspan. But we were really, really fortunate.
Right. So in order to do that, you must have a pretty pretty interesting school layout. I take it you just don't have the normal gym, do you?
Well, no. Well, we're about 35,000 square feet right in the middle of Manhattan on 30th Street, and between Madison and Park. So we are right in the urban setting. We're a vertical campus. We have all of the city noise and all of the things that go along with being in New York City. And you would think that this was an untenable thing to do, given that kids on the spectrum have all kinds of sensory issues. But the truth is that because we spend so much time working on those issues and that's the focus of our program, the place works beautifully. So we do have a regular gymnasium in our vertical campus, and we have an adapted phys ed teacher in there, and that program is really great. But we also have two large sensory gyms, and we have a large occupational therapy department and a large physical therapy department, and they also push into the classrooms, and we use the hallways. So this is a school filled with movement and filled with sensory opportunities all day long. It's a part of our program everywhere we go, including in the classrooms, which all have a sensory corner, and every classroom has a suspended swing for the kids in the classroom. So it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that's got to be huge. I mean, just knowing how I wish I had one of those swings in, my classes as my child grew up, because that would have made things a heck of a lot easier for a lot of things. But that's just outstanding. So
well, we really told people from the minute that they apply that this is not a school where we're telling kids to put their hands down and to sit with their hands folded at desks. If you learn best sitting on a ball, well, then you're going to sit on a ball. And if you need a 10-minute break every single hour to do an obstacle course in the hallway so you can get yourself grounded again, that's what you're going to do. And we take that seriously. So it's part of our program all day long.
Yep, that's fantastic. So can you give us a few examples of some of the treatment plans? Give us, I can't say, a typical child, because there is no typical child. But if you could, pull out, a couple kids and tell us about their treatment plans and what their typical day is like at the Rebecca School.
Okay, well, I'll give you an example of a typical kid at the school, and I'm sure I'll forget some of the things, but we'll go through it. Kids come in on a bus. Most of these kids are traveling on fairly long bus routes. Because we're unique, they come from all over the five boroughs. They also come from Long Island. We have had kids from Connecticut. We've had kids from New Jersey, and that's a fairly sizable bus trip. But because there's no other opportunities to have the kind of program that we have, parents will send their kids. So kids come in on the bus. They come into the school. The staff greets them, takes them to the classrooms, and then typically what kids have are days filled with floor time, which is the play-based piece of the DIR model. So floor time is play with a purpose, and the purpose of floor time is to move kids up the developmental ladder, to join them where they are, and then to continue to move them up the developmental ladder. So kids will be doing floor time in the classroom, and that is part of their academic schedule. If a kid is able to do higher academics, we have regular academics, we have typical science classes, we do fairly typical things. If kids are able to do that, because we want kids to move to less restrictive environments. But for the most part, what we're trying to do all day long is get kids to be part of a continuous flow with other people. This is a disorder of relating and communicating, and so that's the important part for us. Then we might have a push-in music therapy group. We have a music therapist who travels from classroom to classroom and does a whole classroom group. Or you might have a session in the art room. So we have an art teacher and a TA in an art room with a we have a kiln, we have a pottery wheel, we have all the regular art stuff, and so we have regular art classes. We have movement groups throughout the entire day. Then if the kid needs it, and for the most part, as you can imagine, most kids on the spectrum need OT, the kid might have a pull-out occupational therapy session, which might last a half an hour, or the occupational therapist might push in and run a group within the classroom with two or three kids, or the occupational therapist and the speech and language pathologist might be running a cooking group, which is meeting both occupational therapy and speech and language feeding goals. And we also have a really large interactive music therapy department with licensed music therapists who do one-on-one sessions or two-on-one sessions with kids. And they are interactive music therapists who are trained not to do, they're not teaching music to kids. What they're trying to do is take kids and get into a conversation with them musically. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Chuck, but it's a really beautiful thing. And they have to be consummate musicians, and they have to be able to improvise. And for the most part, the therapists that we have are trained in the Nordoff-Robbins method of music therapy, which means that they are interactive and they're improvisational. It's really a beautiful thing, and it matches with DIR. And we give them some of the toughest kids in the school. So the kids who are having real trouble generating language and are having real trouble communicating, we give them a music therapy, and those music therapists get in there, and on day one, it's an amazing thing, begin these musical conversations with kids. So, and then they might have a speech and language session, and the speech and language person might push in or pull out. So kids have a really full day moving in and out of classrooms, being part of dyads, being part of larger groups, being part of circles, being part of affinity groups. But it's pretty varied, and you have to be one talented teacher to run a classroom like that.
Yeah, really, really sounds like it.
It
sounds
is.
Like
it's
these
amazing.
Teachers, they have to be talented, and they have to be on their toes. It sounds
all
like a
long.
Great place. Yeah. Well, there was one thing you mentioned before, and I wanted to talk about this a little bit, because to me, it's been one of the tenets of building a relationship with my son, and that's been the floor time. So can you explain that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. So floor time is what Dr. Greenspan and Dr. Weider called the play part of the DIR model. So they wanted people to get down and figure out what it is that the kid was interested in. And once you figure it out, to get down there and join in it and use that thing as a way in. So very often when I first meet kids, you know, kids are holding on to trains or wheeled vehicles, and they're lying on the floor, and they are watching the wheels go by their eyes. And nobody has been able to sort of crack into that. So I want to get down on the floor and be there with that kid and join them in the joy that they're getting looking at that car. And I may bring my own car to it. I may want to play with their car. I may playfully obstruct the rolling of that car so that we can get into an interaction, the two of us. And I want to take mm-hmm. what was originally a stereotypic sort of behavior, very self-absorbed behavior, and turn it into an interaction. So once I get a kid engaged with me and wanting to go back and forth with me, I have in my mind the developmental levels that we talked about earlier. First, I want the kid to be able to stay calm. Then I want the kid to be able to be with me and be engaged. Then I want the kid to be able to respond to what I'm saying or doing, and for me to respond or to what he's saying or doing. And then I want to do that in a more continuous and fluid way. And then I want to be able to move into the world of fantasy play and move into the kind of play that you see kids, more neurotypical kids, engage in all the time, but which kids on the spectrum will very happily go to, so long as you're willing to really support it and really continue to work with kids. And that's mm-hmm. where kids develop the ability to be abstract. So floor time is this really joyful back and forth, giggly, laughy, if you can make it, fun, friendly thing. As Stanley used to say all the time, remember that affect is your friend. That's your best ally. When you can get a kid happy and loving being with you, that's your best thing.
And what is the age limit for floor time?
I don't think there is an age limit. You know, we go at Rebecca's school right now, we're 4 to 21. And we're doing floor time with the kids. We call it our transitions program. We have to, at the age of 16, start to make a transitions plan for the kids. It's a law, and our transitions program is really doing floor time, but it's doing it in a way that is appropriate for older kids. So whereas you may be lying right on the floor playing with trains with a younger kid, older kids, we're going out into the community, we're going into the supermarket, and we're saying, okay, so what do we need to do next? How are we going to do that? And allowing kids to take the time to process, you know, this very, let's imagine they're in a grocery store, these very confusing grocery stores with, you know, lighting which they may find difficult and noise and distraction and colorful labels. We're giving them the time to process it and saying, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? It's our way of taking floor time to the community. So we are still doing floor time. And I have to tell you, I think that I would want to be worked with in this way, even if I were a fully grown adult and still wanting support on the autism spectrum. It just seems to me this is more respectful, more loving, and certainly more joyful.
Yes, and, you know, it really works to a person's strengths, you know, as opposed to dictating, you know, something to them. And I think it's just human nature that they're going to respond much better.
I agree. And, you know, parents don't want to drag their kids through endless sort of what looks like mindless drills to them. And they but usually by the time that I see a parent and the child, they have been through some pretty dreadful stuff, and they just are hoping that there is something that's not going to require that they force their child to sit at a table, or that they they do some of the mindless things that they've been forced to do. So they're really happy once they find floor time. It seems to me that I end up getting all of the good stuff from the parents that I guess other people have missed.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So we have a couple of minutes left here. I want to talk about, obviously we all don't have access to such a place like the Rebecca School. And if we do, we may not have the resources to send our kids to such a great place. So for those of us who are working through public schools and you know, doing the best we can, what advice can you give to us parents?
Okay, well, I see kids in my private practice, so I go to the public schools all the time, and I talk to the special ed department about what they can be doing for the kid that won't cost them one nickel more, that would actually be in their best interest and would make it so that the kid would make much better progress. So that's actually going to be easy. So I strongly, strongly support a good sensory integration occupational therapy. So very often school districts will say to you, okay, I'm going to give you, you know, 2 times 30 occupational therapy, and then they will say, they won't tell you what the occupational therapy is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth is very, very rarely is the primary thing that you should be working with on with a kid on the spectrum fine motor stuff. So if, you know, your school district has your occupational therapist sitting in a tiny office with a table, and all she has access to is tabletop activities or graphomotor stuff or pincher graph stuff, so they're sorting
mm-hmm.
into bins.
Yep.
Tell her, hey, we really like you. You're a wonderful person. Let me make some suggestions. Let's turn the hallway into your gym. So I'm giving you permission to take him out in the hallway and have him carry a heavy load of books, and we're going to go deliver a load of books up to the principal's office because he said he needed that. And then when we get to the principal's office, he has another set of things that you're going to be carrying to this other place. And, oh, by the way, you're going to have to use a map. I'm not going to help you that much, and you're going to have to figure out your way through this maze of a school. All of those things, those sort of treasure-hunty things that you could do, pushing heavy things, carrying things, moving from spot to spot, are infinitely better than being stuck in a tiny office. Now, if they have a sensory gym, hey, you know, you win. The other thing that I would say is, if I were a parent, I would say, Dad, it's usually dads, Dad, go in and watch the occupational therapist, and then say to her, what is it of all the things you're doing that I could do at home? And oftentimes they lift their kids up. Dads like to bounce their kids on the bed. Dads
yep.
like to hug and tickle their kids. Dads like to play the tickle chase game. All of those things, if you're doing it thoughtfully and you got supported by your occupational therapist, which the school is going to give you anyways, you could do them at home. You could make 10 times as much progress. And for parents, for mothers, and this is usually mothers, although there are great fathers at it too, and by the way, there are great mothers at the tickle chase game. I don't mean to say that. But for mothers, get down on the floor and begin to work in a fantasy-based way with your kid. Do not hold up a cow and say, what is this and what sound does it make? Instead, voice the cow. So you're the cow. Oh, you know, hi, I want to come over and play. And even if your child looks at you like you're crazy, you want the child to begin to think, oh, my gosh, there's something other than pointing at a cow and saying its sound. What is my mother trying to get at? As Dr. Greenspan always used to say, you want to instill in the child the spirit of inquiry. What is it that's going on here? And so this fantasy-based play is so important to child development. So if you only did those two things, got down on the floor and did fantasy-based play with your kid, voicing all these animals, voicing the puppets, don't point at stuff, and also got your kid up and spun them and tickled them and squeezed them and did all of those good things, all of which under the eye of an occupational therapist who the school district is going to give you anyways, you'd make tremendous progress. And while Rebecca School is a great idea, you don't need Rebecca School in every town in this country.
Well, that is great advice, and you know, I hope everyone takes it to heart, because those are great things. Those are exactly the things that when I took my son to his first therapist, those were the things we were doing. I guess it was good advice then. It still sounds like it's good advice now. So, Dr. Tippy, let's talk about your book. Let's give a plug for it. That's, the name is Respecting Autism, the Rebecca School DIR Casebook for Parents and Professionals, and it was co-authored by you and the late Dr. Stanley Greenspan. And also, can you give us the website for the Rebecca School, please?
Okay, so Rebecca School's website is rebeccaschool.org. Really simple, one word, Rebecca School. And the book itself has its own website. It's respectingautism, that's one word, .com. And the book is really about what we do at the school, but it is told from the perspective of the parents. And I really think that's, for your listeners, that's what makes this book interesting. There are 16 case studies, and every study starts with the parents talking about their child as their child grew and how they got the diagnosis and how the family reacted to it and all of the things that they went through. And one of the things I'm hearing from readers over and over and over again is that is like, oh my God, I thought I was the only one who went through this. This is phenomenal. I hear my voice again and again and again. I would swear this child or that child was my own child. And the other thing that's really cool about the book, I mean, I think the book's great because I wrote it, obviously, and it's about a school that I helped to found and that I really think is doing good work. But the other good thing about the book is that it's the only place where you get to see Dr. Greenspan's actual response to case material. So the parents presented to Dr. Greenspan, I presented to Dr. Greenspan, my entire staff presented to Dr. Greenspan, and then Dr. Greenspan said, okay, your program is pretty good, but let me tell you what you need to do. Mom and Dad, here's what you need to do, and the school, here's what you need to do. And he supervised me directly on that piece of it. So you get to hear Dr. Greenspan's voice, which is, you know, this is a brilliant child developmentalist who really no one ever got to hear speak directly unless you went to go see him directly. And this is 16 cases where he weighs in directly on what's going on with the kid. And I have to tell you, some of the insights in this book, they're very typical of Stanley Greenspan, but they're brilliant, and it really gives you a notion of how deeply devoted he was to kids and how beautifully he understood them. So those are the real strengths of this book, I think.
Well, I think the strength of the book, too, is having the football being punted off of the roof and landing by the UPS truck. I got quite a big chuckle out of that.
It was astounding, actually, and bounced and hit the wall of the California Pizza Kitchen, and I had to turn and look to the program director and say, you know, Tina, I think that came off our roof, which is not a good thing in New York City.
Yeah. No, but I tell you what, it's, you know, there are any kids who can figure that out. It's, you know, these kinds of kids, you know, they will find a way. So,
it was astounding.
Yeah. So, Dr. Tippy, thank you very much for joining us. We will have this interview archived on the Coffee Clatch website, so anyone can go back and listen to it. And really want to thank you for joining us tonight, and thank you for the book. It is outstanding to get to read Dr. Greenspan in this kind of format, just listening to him, what his advice is. It's a really outstanding book. So thanks a lot.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Chuck. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay. And as Marianne would always say, I'm having a brain freeze right now. What would Marianne say? She would say, wow. She would say, wow. Let's just leave it at that. She would say, wow. Okay, everybody. Thanks a lot for joining us. And have a good night, and we'll have some of you join us tomorrow for the shows, and if not, we'll talk to you later on in the week. Thanks a lot.